Well, I read your book. I've read a number of these stories before, and it was good to see them back. I think that there was only one story that was missing. I think it was called The American.
That's right. God, you have a good memory. Yeah. I dropped two. I dropped a story called Grace, and I dropped a story called The American, which were, I think, sketches and not what I would consider to be, in the light of what I learned later, kind of complete, you know, short stories. So I dropped those and kept the rest and did a little work on them. I did a little rewriting.
Oh.
Simply because I kept the visions. I kept the visions as they were. I did not change what I perceived to be the reality that I was dealing with at that time. These stories were, after all, written over a period of 30 years. My first story in this book was conceived and then written between the ages of 24 and 25.
That's what story was that?
That's The Blessing. Most of the early stories, The Blessing, The Well, The Groom on Zlata Street, most of the stories were written in my late 20s and going through my 30s. The last story in this, last short story in this collection was written in 1972, which is a story called Lamentations. So that these stories really, by and large, represent the material upon which I cut my teeth as a writer. I learned my craft as a writer. I felt, however, upon looking at them again, that they still were shapely and pertinent, and I think had power. And one of the things that's very nice to discover, and I'm really quite moved to discover, is that these stories, which I wrote so long ago, which represent an earlier phase of my development as a writer, still apparently have the ability to move people.
Well, they certainly do.
And that's so moving to me. I mean, that's a wonderful discovery to make, to see that, you know.
And A Pile of Stones, from which many of these stories came, that was your first book. That's been out of print for...
That's been out of print for a long time, and so indeed has In the Reign of Peace, which was the second volume of short stories. One of the things I'm very excited about is that I've lived long enough to see a rebirth to my work, which fulfills a deep fantasy that I have about the nature of writing and art in general, that it is a question of constantly being reborn to yourself, constantly being, in a sense, reconstituted. And one of the things a writer does is constantly, every time I begin a new book, every time I begin a new project, one of the things that I must do is reconstitute myself afresh, anew, in terms of technical accomplishment, in terms of vision. It's a question of development, an unfolding, a sense of becoming. And so I'm very lucky, and I feel myself extremely happy deep down to realize that these works are going to have a second life,
yeah.
That they already have a second life.
Now, many of these stories came out of your visit to Israel and actually living in the kibbutz. Tell me about that.
Yes, I was 24 years old, and I had my first job as a professional writer. I was very lucky, by a concatenation of accident that I won't go into, I got a job writing a movie for a director who was doing a film, an American director who was doing a film in Israel, a feature film in Israel. I wrote him a story, and it was a rather good story. It was a story, obviously, that had some power, and he raised money on it, and he sent me a cable telegram those years saying, come on out, we're doing it. I arrived in the country, and I was 24 years old. I was a year or two out of college. And I did this film, and I acted in this film, and it's one of the worst. My agent at the time said it was perhaps not the worst movie ever made, but surely the worst film ever released for public.
What was it called?
It was called The Pillar of Fire. But the wonderful thing was that it paid my way. For 2 years I was able to live, although poorly, but I was able to live in Israel, where I really took my first steps as a mature writer. I wrote The Blessing there and gathered material for some of the other stories, and also wrote another film, which was sold in those days, never made, but sold to 20th Century Fox. I wrote it with an American writer, now dead, called named Meyer Levin, and Meyer and I worked on a film, which he had just written a best-selling book called Compulsion, which had been sold to movies, et cetera, et cetera. So it enabled me again. It gave me some more money to enable me to live on for another couple of years. But my experience in that country was extraordinary. It was the first time in my life. I was an American kid at Swarthmore College in New York who found myself in a situation for the first time in which the elementals of life and death were really what counted. It was a situation which was a country at war, as it is today. It was then.
You were there during the war?
I was then. Well, this was in 57, which was after the Sinai campaign, but things were very fluid in terms of security. I mean, it was the ongoing fight. They really, their war has lasted since 1947. I mean, there has really not been now peace except with Egypt that we know. So it was a tense situation. I lived on the frontier on this kibbutz in the northern part of the country and was exposed for the first time in my life to the possibility of getting bumped off by, you know, terrorist action, being shot or blown up. It awakened me in many ways to many of the things that became a source of inspiration and preoccupation to me as a writer for the rest of my life. The experience of the frontier and living on the frontier, on a frontier, this is in the northern Galilee, a very beautiful, wild part of the country, living on a border which was constantly threatened by incursions, was one that sunk very deeply into my imagination and bore fruition as late as my last novel, The Tree of Life, which takes place on the Syrian, not the Syrian, interesting, on the nice slip, yeah, which takes place indeed on the Ohio frontier in, you know, 1811. The idea of the frontier experience and the self-reliance it engenders and the kind of people that it produces was very, very thrilling to me. I've never quite recovered from it. I'm working on a novel now which takes place in the future. It's another meditation on history, but it takes place in the 21st century and will in part take place on the Martian frontier, on colonies which are being established on the planet Mars. I'm very interested in the limits of human experience, which is to say both physical limits and the idea, of course, obviously of spiritual limits. And the frontier has, as an American writer, it's not unusual. The frontier has appealed to the American imagination from the beginning, and it has always appealed to mine.
I thought the juxtaposition of your journal and the short stories, where some of the same events occurred, was very interesting. For example, in the journal you describe a Syrian youth lying dead in a roadway without any apparent wounds, and it's also in the short story. And I thought that was interesting because I could see now how that short story developed in your mind.
I'm so glad you spotted that, because one of the reasons that it's a story called Going Up, which is not one of my favorite stories, but I kept it in this collection simply because I wanted to, for readers like yourself, to alert them, to make them aware perhaps of the process behind an act of fiction, and perhaps by juxtaposing the real experience and the fictive experience, I would alert people, which is apparently what I've done in your case, and I'm grateful for that. The image of the dead child, the innocent child who is killed by God, as in the first story, by cancer at the age of 8, and or killed in the war. No one knows whose shell it was that killed this poor shepherd boy that I saw lying on the road. Or in the end, the murder of this young child that I followed, whose life I followed at the Barbie trial. And so the idea of the death of innocence or of the innocent is one that has preoccupied me all of my life and plays a very great role in my life and surely has in my spiritual development. It's a problem with which I've wrestled all my life and written about.
One of the entries in the book is The Elephant and My Jewish Problem, which is also the title of the book. Tell me, what does this mean?
Well, it simply derives from the old joke about a zoology professor who's giving a course on the elephant, and he asks his students to write a paper on the elephant. And the English student writes on hunting the elephant, and the French student naturally writes on the love life of the elephant, and the Jewish student writes The Elephant and the Jewish Problem. And what this means is, of course, that to be a Jew, surely in the 20th century, but I suspect at any time, is to be obsessed by the idea that everything in one way or another connects with the problem of being a Jew and the problem of Jewish identity. And so this is a selection of stories and journals over 30 years of time, which I think dramatize my own obsession with the Jewish condition of the 20th century. And I think it finds expression in this book in my concern with the Holocaust, which is always there, which is a major theme in this book. As an American, I can only view this obliquely. It seems to be presumptuous to try in any direct expression of this. I don't know it, except in my imagination, what I experienced as a human being. And also the creation of the State of Israel. And then there is in this book a story called Charity, which is about the American immigrant experience, the experience of coming here that my people went through in the early part of the 20th century, the latter part of the 19th century. It's a subject of a novel of mine called My Own Ground, which was my first novel. And so I tried in this book to deal with those over the years those things which I found to be pertinent. And it turns out, I suppose, that if you are a Jew living in the 20th century, that everything that happens historically turns out to be directly related to being a Jew. It is one of the salient facts of your existence. You cannot help this, and you have to deal with it. And it seems to me forging an identity is one of the interesting things that happens to a human being. One of the things that I'm grateful about being a Jew is it has enabled me. It is the core of, one of the cores. I mean, there are many cores. We all have many, many nuclei of personality development and characterological development. But surely being a Jew is absolutely essential to me, and I think it's inescapable. I was born in 1933 and came to awareness when the concentration camps were opened, and so.
And yet, the stories that take place on the kibbutz, the people didn't seem very Jewish. In fact, they weren't religious at all.
Well, one of the themes of this book is something which I think is something I'm very proud about, actually. I saw in some sense when I was quite young and began writing, I instinctively perceived several problems which seemed to remain problems and to remain of interest. One of those was the problem of Israel or the Jews re-entering history and assuming power in a state, and what happens when this occurs, the tragedies that result, the tragedy of the assumption of power, the tragedy of violence. The second is the conflict, which is very, very prominent today and which will increasingly preoccupy not only Jews, but obviously all of us in civilization, is the conflict between the secular vision and the religious vision. And I think that one of the things that perhaps this book is about, this book is not just about Jews, this is about the human condition. And the Jewish experience is indeed a metaphor. Any experience is a metaphor for the human condition. If it's a good book, if they're good stories, what you're writing about is human beings. You are being specific. But on the wider ramifications are, of course, the human condition. It seems to me that all of us are now in world civilization confronting the conflict between secular values and religious or and sometimes fanatic values. It seems to me that this ongoing drama is one of the things that constitutes civilization as we are moving into the 21st century. It was something that I surely would not have anticipated, and I think a lot of my friends, a lot of people with whom I speak, we thought that perhaps we were moving towards a more secular vision, a more scientific vision of human destiny. It turns out that we are not, that the old beliefs, the ancient beliefs, the hereditary gods, as the wonderful cosmologist by the name of Harrison points out, are with us forever. And this is one of the great dramas of the human condition.
And yet I can see that the characters on the kibbutz in your story say, I'm a Jew, so what?
Well, I think that one of the things that has...
They're not kosher, they don't recognize the Sabbath.
One of the things that has happened with the creation of the State of Israel is that Jewish identity, which was hitherto for millennia, thousands of years, 4,000 years, built upon the idea of a religious identity, now in the modern world as a result of the State of Israel, is a national identity, which is to say simply a question of belonging to a country, having a common historical experience. And there are, I would say, the vast majority of Israelis are people who are secular in their belief and who hold secular values. There is a small and vocal minority of religious people, but I would say the vast majority of people there are not. And that's something new. I have a dear friend who is a physician, a distinguished physician up at PNS, physicians and surgeons in New York, and Tom and I were talking about our backgrounds, and Tom comes from a background. His people went out to Utah, and some of them are Mormon and some not, but it's a background which is, he said to me, I think he said, I come from three or four generations of secularists, of atheists, of people who rejected a long time ago whatever Protestant religious tradition they had. And I laughed. I said, well, that's kind of interesting because I, as a Jew, come from... My father remains, although aged, a religious man. But as recently emancipated as a Jew, it is only in my generation, my mother is also secular, but it is only in my generation, only one generation, in which the secular values have taken hold. Because it has only been very recently in Jewish experience that when the vast migration from Europe took place, And the vast majority of people who came to the United States or came to Israel were indeed religious. But the Jews have just been recently exposed to values which are secular.
And well, I think this is this assimilation is characteristic of almost every subsequent generation in this country.
Quite precisely,
I mean,
sure.
There's no longer an Irish ghetto that I know of. There are Irish pockets here. And
I think that one of the things...
Italian, Italian neighborhood.
It is characteristic, it seems to me, about civilization. I am a firm believer that American civilization is... American civilization is the best idea that God ever had. And I believe this because I believe that it expresses something which is true of the universe, which is to say, it is based upon diversity. And I think that the universe itself, I agree with Freeman Dyson, this marvelous man at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, this great cosmologist and scientist, who says that diversity is the universal principle. It is that principle which enables life to endure, to prevail, because it maximizes adaptation. It maximizes the possibility of survival. And I believe, too, that this is true in terms of human civilization, that the more diverse elements comprise a culture, the better that culture is, the richer it is. And one of the things that we were all vastly beneficiaries from in America is the fact that... we are comprised of so many groups. And increasingly new groups coming. It seems I am amused to discover now that my story of immigration, my family story of immigration coming here, is old hat. Because there are many new stories. The whole Asian experience and the Hispanic experience remains something new. Or the black experience moving from the rural to the urban environment, which has really occurred en masse since the Second World War.
This feeling of assimilation that I referred to a moment ago is reflected in our speech, in our language to a degree. In England, as you know, anybody who speaks there immediately identifies his class, his income, his social standing, his education. But in the United States, our accents, while there are regionalisms, are almost alike. So you will find an educated person like... a Yale-educated person such as Bush dropping his G's.
Yes.
And son of immigrants like Michael Dukakis not, and yet their language, their speech is almost identical.
Yes. Well, it's something which is, again, the result of the American democratic process. It is that process that has enabled me, as a Jew in this culture, to move quite easily as a writer between the Jewish experience and the American frontier experience, without giving it a second thought. I mean, I do not feel that I am somehow outside of an experience or only locked into one aspect of human experience. I can, because I am fortunate enough to be American, make myself privy to, by an exercise of my imagination, any aspect of experience that I so choose to write about.
Even writing about Martians.
Even writing about Martians or about human beings colonizing the planet Mars. And this seems to me, this freedom that has been given me, in America, and given all of us, is something that is immensely precious. It is certainly at the root of my seeking to express myself as a writer.
Now, in The Elephant in My Jewish Problem, one of the most poignant episodes deals with the journal taking place at the Barbie trial in France, in Lyon. Tell me about that. And you teamed up with Mark Rabua.
Yes.
Man, I interviewed just a short while ago.
Really?
Was he staying with you, by the way?
Mark was not. Mark was staying in New York with a dear friend of mine, a member named Aaron Asher, an editor in New York. But Mark and I have become quite friendly in the last 3 or 4 years. And when I decided to go to the Barbie trial, I did so because I wanted very much to follow the fate of one of these children who had been deported from this town of Izyur.
Well, tell me about the child.
Well, what happened was I discovered about him in a wonderful book that Harry Abrams published in New York called The Children of Izyur, which was written by Serge Klarsfeld, who's a famous Nazi hunter. And Klarsfeld had uncovered, or really brought again to the attention of the world, this extraordinary story of 44 children who were kept in a so-called safe house by the resistance, the Jewish resistance, during the Second World War in Lyon, outside of Lyon. And they were betrayed, and Klaus Barbie, who was the Gestapo chief in the city of Lyon, that district, came one morning in April 1944 and rounded them up and dispatched them first to Drancy, which were first actually to a prison, a terrible prison in Lyon called Fort Malouk. And from thence they were taken to Drancy, and there they were eventually dispatched to Auschwitz, where they met a horrible end. And I became obsessed with the fate of these children because, let's face it, I am roughly their contemporary, I mean, within a couple of years. And had I been a child, a Jewish child living in Europe, that would have been my fate. Who am I kidding? And so I thought to deal with this as one of these children, Georgi Halpin, was indeed a doppelganger to me. And I began identifying with him very strongly. I visited his parents, as I wrote in this book, and then I went to Lyon. Actually, I had known Mark before. Mark and I had been friends before. And Mark and I realized we were both interested in the Barbie trial. Mark was indeed a member of the resistance in Lyon. He's a Lyonnais, and he grew up in Lyon and joined the resistance along with his brother Jean. He comes from a very interesting family. And I had never had the experience. Mark is, he's an artist. He's a marvelous photographer, as you know. I never had the experience of following a photographer of this caliber, any photographer, surely a photographer of this extraordinary caliber around. And what I did was simply attach myself to him as a friend and an observer in Lyon and got him interested in the fate of Georgi Halpern so that his imagination was also excited by the destiny of this poor child. And I simply trailed after him and then began realizing and taking notes that he would become a significant character in this journal because he represents, if you will, the French intellectual, the French human being who, yes, more than intellectual, human being who actively resisted evil, who when he was 21 years old decided to do something about the National Socialism, about the Germans, the occupation of his country, and join the resistance, and was almost killed in the Vercors. He fought in the Vercors. But I had a wonderful experience for, I guess it was a month, just walking, you know, spending time with Mark, visiting with him, through him, an extraordinary Jesuit priest, Father Frez, who was an old friend of Mark's from Lyon, who was also in the resistance, and through Mark really was able to get something of a picture of what it must have been like during the occupation in Lyon, and also listening to some of the wonderful stories that Mark told me about his own experiences. And it formed, we doubled up again. He became, in a sense, a double of mine again. And so there are several doubles in this. And I think it, I'm glad that it moved you.
You quoted from the child's letters.
Yes, I got these with the help of Yad Vashem, which is the Israeli, it is attached to the Israeli memorial to the Holocaust in Jerusalem. They have a vast archive there. And some people there helped me very much getting these letters, which were in the archives, and using them. They had originally been deposited there by the parents of Georgi Halpern.
He was a child facing death, and he worried about shoes.
Yes, well, he was, after all, when he was murdered, he was 9 years old. I mean, you know, was he aware? It's horrific to think that in some sense these children indeed must have been aware that they were in danger. There's a heartbreaking moment which occurred with Monsieur Favre quoting the morning that the Germans came to take the children away. One of the children, a 15-year-old boy, turned to him and said, Julien, talking to this French lovely man, Julien, this is the end for us. I mean, the 15-year-old knew that the end indeed had come and that they were to be taken to be murdered. The idea of the murder of children seems to me the most atrocious act a human being can commit. And if anything is revelatory of diabolic evil and radical evil in the human heart, it seems to me the murder of children is.
What was that trial like?
Well, it was the second trial of a war criminal that I've attended in my life. The reason I think half-consciously that I wanted to go there was because many, many years earlier, when I was 28 years old, in 1961, I had attended the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem. And that trial was, in a sense, much more traumatic for me because I was young, and it was the first time in my life when I was confronted week after week after week by an exposure to this man in the glass box and the extraordinary revelation of evil that these things showed the world. I mean, the Holocaust shown for what it was. And so I think that the Barbie trial was less shocking to me in that regard. I had already been through this. But it was fascinating. The juxtaposition of living in the city of Lyon, which is a very, very, very elegant, chic city, a terrific city. I stayed in a wonderful hotel, and there was a wonderful restaurant nearby that I wrote about. And Mark and I enjoyed ourselves eating, and we drank, and good wine. And then every day, that juxtaposed to the experience every day in court, listening to the revelation of what happened in that city throughout the 40s. The early 40s up till liberation, which was 44, was appalling and very strange. Mostly, however, my concentration was upon the fate of this one child as a representative of the 44 children, as a representative of all the children who had been murdered during that time.
Well, these war criminals, there's no punishment for them.
No,
I
don't think you can punish them. I think that the important thing is not to punish them, but simply, in our lifetime, put them on trial so that human beings can think about what it must, what it, well, it's again, it's connected to this thing that we said earlier, talk about diversity. Primo Levi, who's a very great writer, who was in Auschwitz and wrote, I think, the masterpiece about the experience of being in Auschwitz, a memoir, a very, very great book. In a book, I guess it was republished just before he died a year or two ago, and he said in that book that the tragedy of National Socialism, the tragedy of Nazism, was that the Germans suddenly, they regarded the stranger as an enemy, which is to say that they admitted of no diversity. And I think that the essential tragedy of the Holocaust, as the essential tragedy of any human conflict which expresses itself so horrifically, is that when human beings cease, when they regard strangers as enemies, when we revert to that ancient, hideous tribal mentality, that Ice Age mentality, that if you're not a member of my family, and if you're not a member of my clan, and if you're not a member of my tribe, you are not only something, you are beyond the pale, you're an enemy.
Now, wait a minute. In one of the stories, I can't remember which one, you have I think he's a blacksmith.
Yes, yes.
He's a blacksmith, and he murders the woman next door, who's lived next door for 20 years or so. They were neighbors. Murders her, and then goes back to work.
Because
she certainly wasn't a stranger.
Well, but she was.
What story was that?
That was a story called The Crazy Old Man,
yeah.
And it's an anecdote told, and precisely this, he murders her because she was a Jew. And because he was a Russian peasant who had been brought up to regard the Jew as an enemy, essentially a stranger. So even though they lived side by side for years, there was something in him that said that this human being, because she was different from him and diverse from him, was an enemy. And it seems to me that unless human beings get over this idea, that unless we really admit to a diversity and celebrate the principle of diversity, the human race, it seems to me, is going to destroy itself.
Well, this was certainly an aberration in Germany. Last week, I did an interview with Elie Wiesel, and we talked for a long time, and both of us stated our bafflement over why this occurred. He has no idea why it happened. The stranger theory is certainly one of them. But he was telling me that when he was released from Buchenwald, the Americans came in. And he will always remember a big black soldier, great big man, obviously unafraid of anything. And he says, these soldiers started crying when they saw the pitiful people who survived Buchenwald. He had no place to go. His whole family had been murdered. And France said, bring the children here. He was 13, 14, lived in an orphanage and grew up in an orphanage in France. And he said, there's that phrase, the wonderful phrase, the kindness of strangers that Tennessee Williams used.
Yes.
And he says, in a way, he's always fallen back on the kindness of strangers, generosity of others. He's needed that to survive. There's no answer to it. No, nobody knows why. It's just, I did another interview recently with Ian Thomas, who wrote The White Hotel.
Yes, wonderful.
And we talked, just cut it last night.
Oh, sorry, excuse me.
We just cut the I'm losing my train of thought.
Talking about Thomas's The White Hotel.
I just cut the piece last night, and did you read
the Yes, White of course. Hotel?
And Thomas had read Bobby Yar, and that had moved him very much. The impersonal way that, of course, I guess all death is impersonal in some respects, but it didn't matter to these people what they were, who they were. They were killing the guards. They wanted to have no witnesses. They knew they were doing something wrong.
Yes, that's
it.
Yes.
And they try to cover it up.
Right. Why, yes. It seems...
not even an act of war.
It seems to me that what has happened in the 20th century is something that the human race is going to have to live with for the rest of time. And that is that in the midst of our so-called civilization, we saw a so-called belief in progress. Now, the black experience surely has been 300 years and of oppression and terrifying experience of the slave experience, the middle passage, you know, bringing of millions and millions and millions of helpless human beings to these shores. But we somehow believe that in the 19th century and the early 20th century, that progress was being made, that a developmental stage had been reached where the earlier excesses were simply impossible. And then it turns out that both in Germany and in Russia, there arise movements, the Nazi movement and the communist movement, that are capable, or not, recently in Cambodia, that are capable of such unimaginable ferocity that maybe in human history this has not been equaled. What I'm trying to say is that it is a lesson that we're going to have to deal with, the mystery of evil which persists and exists in our heart. It may be indeed, although I do not believe in a supernatural being, I do not believe in God, but it may be indeed that the religious vision is more real than a progressivist vision of humanistic development, which is to say that human beings are unredeemed, that evil exists and has always existed within us, and that our major problem to the end of time is wrestling with the devil who exists not outside, but within our own heart. And it seems to me that the 20th century, if it has taught us anything, has taught us to beware that this evil may indeed erupt at any time. And this, it seems to me, our major job in civilization is to guard against that. One of the definitions of culture, of civilized countries, or civilized nation, is, it seems, how do they treat the weak and the unprotected, the aged, the children, the sick. I mean, one of the ways in which you define civilization is how does that civilization treat those people who cannot fend for themselves? And whenever you see a culture unable or unwilling to do that, then it seems that something else has entered. Then it seems that a kind of cruelty and indifference and a coldness to one fellow's human being has arisen. And this is in some way an eruption of evil which is going to have dreadful consequences.
Well, I saw a photograph of Gorbachev. The grim-faced Gorbachev was the caption, boarding his plane to go back to deal with efforts to help the survivors of the earthquake. And I began to think of the hypocrisy that the communists have overrun those nations and murdered millions
yes.
of people. We don't know how many people they murdered. You can't get in there. You can't count them.
It strikes me, too.
I've seen estimates between 12 and 19 million people, and he's going to go over there and lead efforts to help the survivors. How many people have the communists, not him directly, but...
But his system put to death. Yes, of course. How many Armenians were slaughtered during the purges, for example, or the consolidation of the Soviet regime? This is something that... indeed struck me. The only hope is that perhaps he represents something new and better. One hopes for the Russian people, and one hopes also for the world, because if there is a kind of liberalization, it will make it possible for, obviously, a lot of things to occur, which will not end in an alternate end than atomic war. One of the things that you'll learn is that there are no solutions, it seems to me, in life, and all you can do is...
I don't know. You, when I was about 20, I had all this.
Yes, I did too. But I was disabused quite rapidly of these fantasies. One of the things that's nice about being a writer, I suppose it's an abnegation of certain responsibilities. My job is, as Conrad said, to make people see, therefore to make them feel. If I can do that, then I'm fulfilling at least some function.
Or can you and do
having,
it? You can
serve. Well, thank you for that. But that's my job, and it seems to me that, as I said, I get a kick out of the fact that realizing that the work that I did in this earlier incarnation of my being, remains able to move people and perhaps give them an emotional experience and maybe think about certain aspects of the human condition.
Great to have these stories back. And some of the journals, the journal about the Barbie trial, what was that published?
Well, that's actually an amusing story. What had happened was that I was hired by Life magazine to go there and to write this piece. And the two editors that hired me were fired in the middle of this assignment. And the people who took over didn't want the piece. And
So it has been in a drawer.
It
was so interesting the way you handle it, because you would have these asides saying, Georgie would have been 51 years old today, or something like that. I can't remember exactly
how you phrased it.
But all the way through it, you brought it home.
Yes, I tried to show the pertinence of the past to the present, and hopefully to the future, a lesson for the future. And I think the new editors who came, they were not moved, they did not grasp.
Wasn't their assignment.
Yes, and that, of course,
that's their loss.
Yes, well, thank you for saying that. It's a piece that I'm proud of, because it's a piece that I think, I have a feeling will be around for a while. People will look at this piece when they think about the Barbie trial, because it's an oblique vision of something going on around this trial. But I think we'll have the ability to move people in the future. I hope so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.